Right? Too many times I was told, others are told, oh, you're ambitious. And it's not meant as a compliment, which when you think about it is ridiculous.
Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the world's first podcast aimed at supporting and empowering medical women in their careers. I'm Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram, and it's my honor and joy to be your host as each week we speak to a fantastic guest who's here to help us in our careers. I'm Vice President of the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK, and the voice of medical women on medical issues. Join us as each week we hear about a topic that's helpful for all of us in our careers. Hello, everyone. I hope that you are all keeping well, and I hope you've enjoyed our mini series on women's health. Thank you to Health Innovation, Kent, Surrey, and Sussex for sponsoring those episodes. We're continuing the series of how to with an episode on how to be unapologetically ambitious with the fabulous Shelley Archambault. Shelley is the best-selling author of the book Unapologetically Ambitious, which has sold more than 60,000 copies worldwide. And she is one of tech's first female Black CEOs, which is quite a rare thing in Silicon Valley. So she became CEO of a company after she had worked at IBM for quite a few years. And she's also been on the board of several companies. And she writes a lot about how women can be unapologetically ambitious. And I thought this was the perfect time to put this episode out because in the medical world, particularly in the UK, it is the time where lots of applications are open. So people are applying for specialty training, subspecialty training, or if you want to switch specialties. And so I thought this would be a really nice booster episode for people to listen to while they're doing their applications in case anyone's feeling any imposter syndrome or feeling like they haven't done enough. I hope that this episode will really, really help you to own your achievements and what you've done. And I think even the word ambitious brings different reactions, I guess. Sometimes it's used in a derogatory way. It's kind of, oh, you're really ambitious. It's not given as a compliment to women. And there's studies where if a man is seen to be ambitious, people think more highly of them. Whereas if a woman is seen to be ambitious, that's kind of frowned upon. And it's just bizarre that these sorts of things exist in society, but they do. We want, if men aren't very ambitious, we think, oh, there's something wrong with them. And if women are ambitious, we think there's something wrong with them. But actually, everyone's allowed to be as ambitious as they want to be. And I first read Shelley's book a couple of years ago when I was applying for something. And I found it really helpful. I can't believe it was 2 years ago. It really helped to make me think, yes, I can do this. I can earn my achievements. And so I hope that this podcast episode does that for you. One of the main things that I learned from the book was something that Shelley says. Is she says, tell people what you want to do because then they can help you to get there. A lot of the times I think we kind of feel a bit nervous about telling people about this is what I want to do because we worry about what their reactions will be. What if they tell us, like, don't be ridiculous, you can never do that. But if you tell people, then they can help you. And actually, I read that around the time that I was thinking of starting this podcast and thought, okay, I'm going to try it. And I did. I put out in one of our Medical Women's Federation newsletters, I said, oh, I'm thinking of starting this podcast. I don't really know what I'm doing. If anybody has any advice or any tips, please could you get in touch? Wasn't expecting the response that I got, which was a lovely email from our editor, Jenna, offering to edit the podcast. She said, oh, I've been wanting to get involved with the podcast for a while. And I would really love to help edit. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm so, so grateful that Jenna did that, but also really grateful that I read that in Shelley's book, because otherwise I might have just tried to work it out by myself rather than putting it out there that actually I want some help with getting this podcast out into the world. And of course, without Jenna doing the editing, it would be really, really hard to get this podcast out. So a huge thank you to Jenna. But that was my biggest takeaway from the book, that actually, if you tell people, they can help you. So if you tell people, actually, like, I think I want to, I don't know, take some time out of training and do some research, or go and do a fellowship on this thing, or I'd quite like to go and do this, then suddenly people start saying, like, oh yes, like, I know somebody that did that, or, oh, you should speak to this person. People do generally, I think, try to help each other. And that brings me very nicely onto how I think the Medical Women's Federation is really, really helpful. I love it as a space where you can come and say, oh, I'm interested in this, and somebody will say, oh yes, I know someone that does that, or go and speak to that person. And this happened with me at our last in-person conference last November. I was speaking to one of our past presidents, Dr. Sally Davies. And I said, you know, I'm really interested in looking at kind of population health and pediatrics and how we can do more health promotion and health prevention. And she said, oh, I know someone that you can speak to, and very kindly and helpfully put me in touch with them. So it's these kind of things that I think are really important for our career, but you need a network to be able to do those things. You need to be able to go to people and say, oh, I'd like to do this. Do you know anyone? And I think the beauty of the Medical Women's Federation is because there are members who are medical students all the way up to retired doctors, people from all specialties, all parts of the country. It's a really nice network where you can suddenly, like, be introduced to different people, and you also get the opportunity to help and mentor other people. So our next in-person conference is next May, on Friday, the 10th of May, 2024, in Cambridge. We've not finalized the title yet, but it's going to be around innovation and challenges in leadership. We've got Professor Dame Leslie Regan, the Women's Health Ambassador, who's going to be coming and giving a talk, and lots of exciting speakers and panels. So definitely do register your interest and look out for the registration page, which will be out very soon. Once it's open, I will, of course, put the link in the podcast notes. It'll be really, really lovely to see all of you there in person. And you can really put into practice the things that Shelley speaks about in this podcast and in her book. In the meantime, I hope that you find this episode really, really helpful in being unapologetically ambitious. So it's wonderful to have with me today Shelley Archambeau. I've just asked you about pronouncing your name, and I'm not sure that I actually pronounced that correctly then.
It's Beau versus Boo. So think
Archambeau.
Of A-R-S-H-A-M-B-O-W.
Archambeau.
Yes.
Well, it's so lovely to have you with me on the podcast, Shelley. I read Shelley's wonderful book, Unapologetically Ambitious, a couple of years ago, and I'm just so excited to get to speak to you. So it would be lovely if you could introduce yourself to our listeners.
Oh, certainly. So I'm Shelley Archambeau. Yes, I'm author of Unapologetically Ambitious, Take Risks, Break Barriers, and Create Success on Your Own Terms. But I'm also a long-term technology executive. I spent my entire career in tech, rising through the ranks at IBM, getting to the point where there wasn't anyone in the company who looked like me that was higher than me. My boss reported to Lou Gerstner, the CEO, and I was running a multi-billion dollar division over in Asia Pacific. I then worked my way to Silicon Valley, where after being the chief marketing officer and EVP of sales of two public companies, I then got the opportunity to become CEO of the software company that became MetricStream. I ran that for 15 years, turning around a troubled company and growing it into a market leader, passed the baton, and now I serve on public boards, as well as national nonprofit boards, advise companies, universities, I speak. I really just try to inspire and impact people so that more people can achieve their aspirations.
Well, I love that. And you certainly do a great job of inspiring people. I found the book incredibly, incredibly helpful and inspiring. It would be great to hear how the book came about. Is it something that you'd been thinking about for a while, or were you approached about it?
Yes, actually, it's interesting, Nithana, because I probably about now 15 years or so ago, I decided I was going to write this book. What happened is throughout my career, I'd always tried to be accessible and approachable. I wanted people to see that, hey, I'm a real person. You can touch me, right? I mean, I'm real, because so many people, as they rise through the ranks, they feel like they're untouchable. And if they're untouchable, then you can't really relate to them, and don't feel like you can become them. Well, I wanted more people to see that, hey, if I could do this, you know, a little girl growing up with a lot of perks and support and things like that, then gosh, anybody can do this. But what happened is, as I took on more and more responsibility in my career, I still responded when people reached out. I still do today, but I couldn't meet with everybody one-on-one. We wanted to pick my brain, hear my story. And I said, you know, when I pass the CEO baton, I'm going to take time to write it down. I'm going to write down what really made Shelly Shelly. I'm going to write down what I learned. I'm going to write down the fact that, you know, life is hard, but nobody tells you it's hard, but here's how to work through it anyway. Because I wanted to be able to share with more people. I find it very frustrating, frankly, that so many people aren't able to contribute to their full capability and capacity. And it's not because they're not smart, and it's not because they're not willing to work hard, and it's not because they're not ambitious. It's because there's so many things that nobody tells you along the way that cause you to get stuck. And once you get stuck, right, then you don't quite get there. So I wanted to write it down to help more people, frankly, figure out how to get unstuck and to keep going.
Well, we're very grateful that you did write that down and share it with us. And as you say, you know, nobody tells us these things, we don't talk about these things. And that's something that I'm really keen for this podcast to do, to talk about the things that we don't usually talk about. And I love that it's called Unapologetically Ambitious, because I think that, you know, even though it's 2023, I still hear like ambition used in different ways when it's used to describe men and women. And for men, it's like, oh, they're ambitious, it's a very positive thing. Whereas for a woman, you kind of hear like, oh, she's too ambitious. Is that why you chose the title?
I'm so glad you asked me that question, because candidly, I had the entire book written. I had it in the hands of a publisher, and I still had no title. Because I wanted ambition in the title for all the reasons you just said. Right? Too many times I was told, others are told, oh, you're ambitious. And it's not meant as a compliment, which when you think about it is ridiculous. What, are you going to raise your children? Tell them to work hard, take extracurriculars, get involved in sports, show leadership, persevere, but oh, don't be ambitious. I mean, what is that, right? And so I said, you know what? I want ambition in the book, but I can't just call it ambition. And I was really struggling. But then I was talking with a group of friends, and we were talking about the fact that women apologize all the time. And I said, you know, I feel like women are raised from the cradle to apologize. And we apologize. Yes, we've done something wrong, but that's maybe 5, maybe 10% of the time we say, I'm sorry. The rest of the time we say, I'm sorry, we do it to make the rest of the world feel better. We do it to show we care, to show empathy, to let people know that we support them, to ease tensions, right? We use, I'm sorry, like people use salt. It makes everything taste a little better. Well, I'm sorry makes the world move a little better, right? Well, we have to stop doing that. And that's when it hit me. I said, you know what? That's it. Unapologetically ambitious. Because everyone has the right to be ambitious, and no one should have to apologize for it.
I love that. And it's so true. We do use, I'm sorry, like salt to think, oh, I'll improve this by saying that. And most of the time we say it when like we're not even the person at fault. It's bonkers.
Right. And so what happens if you're always saying, I'm sorry, then people actually think you are sorry, right? So you aren't quite all that, and you are responsible, and you are, you know, it was interesting. I remember when I was, early married to my late husband. And I finally said to him, I said, you know what? You never say, I'm sorry. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, you don't. You don't say, I'm sorry. And he said, yes, I do. I said, no, you don't. And he said, Shelly, if I've done something wrong and it's all my fault, I say, I'm sorry. Think about that bar. I've done something wrong and it's all my fault, right? Think about that bar. Whereas if he would step on my foot, I'd say, I'm sorry, because obviously my foot was in the way, right? I mean, it's just a completely different paradigm. And that's when it, you know, really hit me in terms of this whole I'm sorry thing. We have to think hard about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's so many pearls of wisdom in your book, Shelley. And I wonder if you can kind of share with us some of the ones that you think are like the most important, or things that, you know, you've had lots of people say, oh, I'm so glad that you spoke about this.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, the whole book is full of wisdom.
Yeah, I was going to say that the nice thing is I've heard really good feedback from the book on many different points. You know, I think, if I just think about the process, if I think early on, it was, even just sharing how strategic I was about planning not just my career, but my life, and how intentional, you know, people, that was something that also came through. Because here's what I believe, you know, a lot of people set goals. You know, I think, oh, one day I'd like to do this personally and professionally, right? Travel here or impact this or create this nonprofit, right? It's something, right? They always have these goals. Well, some people take time to actually say, well, how will I actually make that happen, right? So they might kind of create the outlines of a plan. But what I find is very few people, Nuthan, actually take the time and the intention to make decisions every day consistent with the plan. And that's where the power is. That's where the power is, because it's like compounding interest. You know, if you take one step and then you're moving towards your goal, and you take another step moving towards your goal, and you just keep doing that, before you know it, you're actually there. Versus you take steps, but you're not keeping that goal in mind. So they're not always actually heading towards the goal that you've established for yourself. So being intentional is something that I think I definitely hear feedback from, as people think about, I never thought about being that strategic, especially when it came to personal life, right? As well as professional life. So that would be one. Did that strike you when you read the book?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think the biggest thing for me from the book was when you spoke about kind of sharing, you know, if you want to do something, tell people about it, because then they can help you. People can like introduce you to people and tell you about opportunities. And that was a real light bulb moment for me. I think before that, I don't know if it was like, I used to feel like, oh, I'll be showing off to tell people, or maybe if I tell people, then they'll like copy my ideas. There were like some fears there, I think. But this podcast actually came about because I followed your advice. So I said, you know, I want to start a podcast, and I would be very grateful if anybody has any like tips on starting a podcast. And I put it out on our Medical Women's Federation newsletter, and Jenna, our amazing editor, replied and said, oh, I've been wanting to find a podcast producer. I would love to help with this. And I was like, oh, this is exactly what Shelley means. You tell people, like, this is what I want to do, and then they start helping you to get there. But people can't do that if you don't tell them. And then it's the same with kind of when you create content. Sometimes I think we think, oh, I don't want to share, like, you know, I don't want to be telling people like, oh, there's this podcast episode, because they might think that I'm showing off. But the whole point that you're creating it is for people to be able to listen, and you need to share it. And then they could be like, oh, you should listen to this, or I've listened to this, and then something else comes from it. So I think that was the biggest thing for me.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because you're right. That's been a key to my whole life, is I believe if you tell the universe, literally tell the universe what you want, then the universe will help you. I find it amazing how many people will come to me to say, you know, Shelley, one day I'd like to be X, right? Start my own company, be a chief marketing officer, whatever it might be. And I'm trying to figure out what the right steps are. You're looking for advice. And I'll say, great. I said, who else knows you want to do that? And they'll look at me like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, who else knows that that's what you want to do? And maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a spouse, you know, maybe a sister. I mean, like, no. You have to tell people what you want. If you don't tell them, people who can help you might be passing you by every day. So I honestly believe that's the big thing. But here's the key. And you touched on it too. There's always this fear. Right? There's a fear of, well, gosh, if I put that out there and then it doesn't happen, are people going to think I failed? Or if I put it out there, are they going to think I'm thinking ahead of myself, or I'm too big for my britches, or, you know, whatever it is, what there's always this fear. But here's my view. That fear is really just vulnerability. You're just feeling vulnerable. It's like, ooh, if I put it out there, right? I'm opening myself up. Somebody might hurt me, right? But vulnerability, frankly, goes hand in hand with ambition. It's really hard to achieve and go after your ambitions without being vulnerable at some point, because nobody achieves anything of significance all by themselves. No one. And in order for you to get help along the way, you've got to be vulnerable and ask for it and take it and all those things. So, you know, when you're sitting down there and you're nervous or you're afraid, what I always try to tell people is, listen, when I'm afraid of things, something's worrying me, it's a risk. I find that if I just leave it in my head, it becomes almost like the boogeyman. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and I feel frozen. So what I do instead is, all right, I think I want to do this, but ooh, here are the risks. I literally write it down, because I find that somehow writing it down and looking at it, it becomes tangible and manageable. It's like, okay, so here's the risks. Here's the worst that can happen. Well, what can I do to mitigate that? Who might be able to help me with it, right? What, all of a sudden you can deal with it. So I tell people, get it out of your head. Because when it's in your head, it just grows, right? But if you can take it and write it down, all of a sudden you can deal with it. You can start crossing off things. It becomes tangible. Make it tangible so you can deal with it, and then push through.
Yeah, I love that. I think it is. You're right. When something's in your head, it's just, and it does get bigger and bigger. And then as soon as you write it down or you share it with somebody, it's like a big, oh, okay, this isn't as big as it is inside my head.
Exactly.
And you've been in leadership roles in, you know, for a long time. And as you said, with IBM, and then you were CEO. And I'd love to hear some of your kind of biggest lessons that you learned during that time.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. So probably as a CEO, the biggest thing I've learned, well, the first thing I learned was everybody was right. You know, they tell you when you become CEO, oh, it's lonely at the top. Okay. So you're learning, you're like, yeah, okay, it's lonely at the top. But then when you get the job, it's like, oh, now I get it. You have no peers. For the first time in my career, I had no peers. And peers are helpful because they're the people that you can go to say, ooh, did you hear that? What do you think that meant? Right. Or struggling a little bit with this, what do you think? They're the people that you can go to and have those sidebar conversations. Well, all of a sudden, when you're a CEO, you either work for them, meaning the board, or everybody works for you. You don't have anybody that you can actually let your hair down with and say, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing, right? Because trust me, you have those moments. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this isn't gonna work. I have to go find peers. So I'm a big believer that if you have a problem or an issue, figure out a solution. So I said, all right, I need peers because that's why I'm feeling lonely. So I went and actually created a group. I found other women who were building companies in tech in Silicon Valley, and we came together as a group. And honestly, we met once a quarter, but it wasn't so much the quarterly meetings as it was the relationships we built that we could suddenly be on speed dial. Ooh, right? Facing this. What do you think? Who do you think I should talk to? We stayed together. We're still together, even though we're all, well, not all of us. Most of us have passed the baton in our companies, but we're still together in other organizations. So it was great. So that was the big thing. Number one, yes, it is lonely because you don't have peers. Find them, create them anyway. We all need places to actually have those sidebar conversations. And if you develop that kind of relationship with somebody who works for you, it's a problem. It's a problem because others will see that you have a close relationship with one person or two people and not them. And that creates a really strange dynamic, right? So that's one, create your own peers. The next thing is the importance of how you build your team, right? And talent. And when I learned, I thought, you know, you become a CEO and it's all about the decisions you make. Well, it turns out it's actually not so much about the decisions you make. It's about allowing people who work for you to make decisions. It's trying to make fewer decisions, not more. Because the fewer decisions you make, that means the people who work for you are able to make better and better and better decisions. Because if you're making fewer, they're making more. If they're making more, they're growing. And the whole role of a leader is to create more leaders. So if you're making all the decisions, they're not growing. So that was another key lesson. You tell me how many lessons you want, because I'm telling you, I
learned a lot of it. Oh, please keep going.
Oh gosh, probably the next thing is, it's all about the teamwork. You know, how do you create teamwork so people actually support each other, and it does, and you try to minimize the, you know, the infighting of everybody trying to be the star, be the number one, be the person on the team. So how do you create that overall teamwork? So one of the things that I did as part of overall annual evaluations is I put a bonus in place around the person, and I think I had two, the top two people of my direct reports that were rated by their peers as the best teammates. So what I did was every time when it came time for reviews, I put out this literally it was like a survey. We had a set of questions to ask about each of your peers around, you know, do they follow the values? Do they make and keep commitments? Did I write all the key things that I thought were as important for leaders? And they rated each other on it. And then whoever actually was, and all those things were designed to be teammate, right? Values. And whoever the top two people that got the highest votes got a bonus. And you know what? Teamwork improved. So you have to be intentional. Now, I'm not saying that's the way you have to do it. Figure out what works for you, right, in your environment. But you really have to be intentional as a leader to ensure that those that work for you, that you are fostering good teamwork. Because it's through the teamwork that you really get the performance and the outsized outcomes.
These are really helpful. And, you know, I know they're kind of lessons from when you're a CEO, but they're applicable to all of us at whatever stage of our careers that we're in. You mentioned when you introduced yourself, Shelley, that at IBM, there wasn't really anybody more senior than you that looked like you. And I wonder if you can speak a bit about what that experience was like for you.
You know, it was interesting. IBM was actually a great company. IBM was focused on diversity, both from a gender as well as an ethnic standpoint, long before a lot of other companies were focused on that. So that was the good news. It was still tech, though. And in tech, right, numbers were still smaller. The big thing that I would say drove a lot of it for me is I had aspirations. I was working hard to rise through the ranks to be able to compete for the CEO job. And therefore, yes, I was ambitious. I was moving around a lot, you know, all of those things. And I ended up therefore being, you know, I hit a number of firsts where I was the first one to do this or the first one to do that, right? That kind of thing. But frankly, it wasn't so much being the first, right? Or the only, as it was learning how to be effective anyway, right? How to be effective anyway. So I didn't so much focus on the fact that I was the first or the only. I knew when I took new jobs, especially when I was moving to new areas so people didn't know me, or to new countries, right? Where definitely people didn't know me, that they were going to underestimate me. They were going to think that maybe I was there for reasons other than the fact that I'm competent. All right. So I knew that. I didn't wear it as a chip. What I did was I said, all right, I know what I have to do, right? I need to come in. I need to build trust and respect and demonstrate, right, the fact that I'm good at what I do. And so that's what I always did. Whereas it ended up being an advantage to me as I rose through the ranks, because what happened is I went overseas. Well, when you go overseas, I approach it the same way. All right, they're going to underestimate me. Let me come in. Here's how I do it, right? I had this whole approach. But people who had never been a minority who went on overseas assignments, they didn't really understand that everything they've done didn't just come with them. And people didn't just give them, right, the assumption and all that, because they've always, that's the way it's always been. You know, mm-hmm. They walk in and people assume, well, if they got the title, they got the job, they're obviously capable, right? But when you go overseas, it's a little different. So that ended up being a big advantage for me, And it's funny, just as a side note, I tell people all the time, as a female or a minority, do overseas assignments. Because if you've learned how to be successful in your own country and in your own, you know, therefore environment, you're going to be really successful international, because you've learned, you don't realize it, but you've learned the tools of how to be successful in environments that don't give you the benefit of the doubt.
And that's great that kind of having that insight then was really helpful for you when you did go overseas. But I think it's so important to talk about this, because a lot of the time, you know, we say that you can't be what you can't see. And I think it's great that IBM did have diversity and things on its radar really early on. But yeah, I think it is important. And kind of sometimes...
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, of course.
Because I almost don't like that phrase, you can't be what you can't see. And I know we use it to help say, hey, let's make sure there's role models, right? But somebody has to be first. Whatever it happens to be, somebody has to be first. So if somebody has to be first, it might as well be you, right? I almost say it's harder, right? It's harder to be what you can't see, but it's not so much you can't,
mm-hmm.
Right? There are a lot of people who have, and that's how we all get the opportunity, right? To follow in footsteps and things like that. So just a quick side, that's just a little pet peeve of mine.
Yep. And thank you for that, because that is really important. And again, actually with the Medical Women's Federation, I'm the first non-consultant, like junior doctor, to be the vice president. And again, yeah, that was a case of me being like, oh, but I haven't seen anybody else do that before. And my dad was like, well, somebody has to be the first. Why can't it be you? And I was like, oh, yeah,
right. That's
a good point. Yeah, why can't it be me? So yeah, I like thinking about it that way. So thank you for sharing that. Now, I know that there's now a paperback version of the book. And I remember reading that had like an extra chapter, or it had something. And I've got major FOMO that I'm missing out on that with my hardback version. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, because I think it was it like more of an assessment kind of? I'm not really sure, so I'll let you talk about what it is.
Sure. So what I added to the paperback, and it was really based on feedback, meaning people gave me feedback that they really liked the book. They asked if there was a workbook to go with it. And I was like, ooh, I hadn't thought of doing a workbook. So what I did was I basically created, you know, a career planning guide is the way to think about it, or life planning guide that I put in the back of the book. So what it did is for each chapter, it basically put out a set of questions to ask yourself to kind of help you think through your life, your decisions, right? Your goals, all those things. So therefore, after you read the book, you could go through and you could kind of ask yourself these questions. And if you wanted to, you could go back and refer, you know, to the chapters to get some thoughts and ideas. But it was really meant to help you kind of ingest, if you will, some of the key points, and then figure out how it applies to you, your life, your aspirations. Because yes, I wanted to become a CEO, but the book is not written to say you should become a CEO. Right? It's not for that. The whole point is you decide what you want out of life. You decide. And then once you decide what you want, then go after that, whatever it happens to be.
That's great. And I will definitely get, I want the workbook now, so I can work through it. But it's such a helpful book. And I think kind of really helps us to think about being strategic. And as you say, you know, just when you were speaking about it then, I was kind of reflecting, I'm not sure if every day I'm actually making decisions consistent with where I want to head to. But you're right, it can't just be like, oh, once in a while I think about this. It needs to be right every day. This is where we're aiming towards. This is the North Star that we're going towards.
Right, because it just helps you figure out how to use your time. You know, when we're younger, we think the resource that is so short is typically money, right? But in all actuality, when you look over the arc of your life, it's time. It's time. And so the reason I think it's so important to be intentional is that you can use your time wisely, and that you can invest in yourself in the right areas, understanding what skills or experiences might be helpful based on where it is you're trying to go. So spend time building those and getting those experiences versus potentially something else. You know, it's funny, people will come to me sometimes and they want advice. They say, oh, I have job opportunities. I can do X or I can do Y. What do you think I should do? And my first question is always the same. Well, what are your goals? Where do you want to be in, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years? And the answer is, I don't know. And I said, okay, well, if you don't know, then the hard answer is then it doesn't matter what job you take. Doesn't matter. It's like being in a car, right? Do I go right or left? Where are you trying to go? I don't know. Then you know what? Doesn't matter. You can drive around anyway. So that's why goals are important. And I'll tell you, you know, some people struggle with, oh gosh, there's just so many options. I don't know what I want to do, right? I get that. If you really don't know what you want to do, then fine. Do things that build skills that are in demand, right? Don't just sit there doing sideways stuff, right? Build skills that are in demand. Because if you don't know what you want to do, it doesn't matter, right? It's kind of like being in school, right? You take the courses you need to be able to get in the college you want to, right? Take, I mean, it's not because those were the courses that you were just dying to take. Well, treat your career the same way, build skills. And that way, hopefully along the way, as you're building skills that are in demand, you'll figure out what you want to do. And now you'll have skills that are in demand, which will give you better opportunities. If you need to pivot or you need to change, you've now got skills that people want, right? So don't, whatever you do, don't stay stuck, right? Don't sit there and don't know what to want to do. So I'll just do anything. No, at least build skills.
Yeah, that's so true. And there's so many skills that are in demand that I think that's really helpful. I just want to touch on kind of negotiation, Shelley, because I think, again, that's something that, you know, certainly in the UK, and if I think about the medical profession, we don't really get taught. And then there's always data about that gender pay gap and gender pension gap and, oh, well, women aren't negotiating enough. And so I wonder if you can kind of just give us some of your top tips, because I imagine you've been on both sides of negotiations.
Yes, I absolutely have. And I'll tell you, I learned about negotiation really out of necessity. So let me just tell you a quick story that gives you the backdrop, and then I'll tell you a story later in career. So the early story was, here I was, I'm in college, and I'm interviewed for IBM. I'm going to get the job I wanted, which is a sales job, because every single CEO at IBM started out in sales. So that's what I wanted. And they come back to me and I'm all excited and they give me the offer. And I had student loans, right? I need to be independent, the whole bit. So I kind of figured out what I thought I needed to make. And IBM came to me with an offer. And the offer was short of what I felt I needed. And so they made me the offer and I said, listen, I am so excited about the opportunity to potentially work for IBM. Right? This is something I've wanted to do, blah, 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 blah. And I said, however, I've actually put together my budget of what I need to be able to pay my student loans, to be able to get a place to live, da, 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 da. And I need, and it wasn't a lot. I mean, at the time, you know, it sounds small, but you have to remember how many years ago, but I basically needed $2,500 more a year. All right. That's what I needed. And the person paused and said, does that mean you won't join us? And I said, well, I'm not saying that, but I am saying this is really what I need. And I really want to come work for this company. So I'd really appreciate it if you could see what's possible, right? So I didn't say no, but I also did not say yes, that I was going to join, right? I just said, here's what happened. They came back and I ended up getting I got more than the 2,500, mainly because I think it was just a rounding number if they added so much a week, you know, kind of thing. But anyway, so I got it. And I was like, okay, right? What I learned is, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that could happen is they could say, no, we can't do it. But they weren't going to rescind the offer, right? So I took that to say, every role, you know, I got after that, I always asked for a little more. Because once you get into business, you realize every job has a band, right? A band at which they're willing to pay. So I always ask for a little more. They say no, you're no worse off. And if they say yes, you're better off. Now, Let's fast forward. I've learned that you can ask for a whole lot more than just here's a little raise or here's a little thing. The key is if you build skills that are in demand, you're good at what you do, and you build a strong reputation, you have a lot of leverage. So fast forward in my career. I'm now interviewing for a job. I'm living in Dallas, Texas, and I'm interviewing for a job that's going to be in San Francisco, California. They want me to become the head of sales. Yeah, they want me to become the head of sales. So the EVP of sales. And I say, okay, help me understand how you're going to measure success on the job. So success on the job is growing their revenue, growing lines. This was a telecommunications company. It's going to be growing revenue and doing it quickly. Okay. And it was going to be reducing their overall cost of sale because they've been spending too much in customer acquisition. Right. So all these things they kind of went through. So I went, in that case, I want responsibility, not just for sales, but also for marketing. And they were like, well, we already have a head of VP of marketing. I said, I understand, but I'd like that person to report to me. And the reason is, if you want me to reduce the cost of sale, so here's the key. When you negotiate, you have to tell them why it's in their interest. If you want me to reduce the cost of sale, marketing plays a key role in the total cost of sale. They gave me marketing. Then, just when they think they're final, they give me the price, the package, they're going to move me and my family, right? All these things are going to happen. One more thing. I said, you know, you told me speed of execution is really important. For me to get off the ground really quickly, I want you to hire my current assistant in Dallas, and I want you to move her and her family to San Francisco too. And you know what? They did. Again, worst that could happen is they would say no. But the key is if you build a strong reputation, you have a track record for success, right? And you build skills that people want and you are in demand, you actually have a lot of power. But the key is, if I had started right in the beginning saying, okay, well, you have to give me marketing, you got to move my sales, you got to do everything all up front. No, it wouldn't have happened, right? You have to do it in the right order and you have to explain to them, make sure they understand why it's in their best interest to do it, right? You're doing this and asking this actually for them and for them to be successful. That's what's key in negotiating.
That's so helpful. Shelley, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been so wonderful to speak to you. And as I said, I loved reading your book. I found it so helpful. It's helped me to start this podcast and I've read it before interviews for various things. So yeah, just a huge thank you for what you're doing and thank you for sharing your wisdom with all of us.
You're welcome. And listen, just so your listeners also know, I do a monthly Ask Me Anything. I'm still trying to be accessible and reachable. So YouTube channel, you can register and they'll notify you of when my next one is. But I do it live on Instagram and also on YouTube. So feel free to join. If you have any questions or anything that you want to talk about, that's the time to do it.
Wonderful. I will put links to all of that in the show notes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you. And all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.